Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be riding the UK's current zeitgeist and engaging, nostalgically, with the Monocle Weekly's majestic past.
That's right, a bumper best of is on the way. We'll be revisiting chats with authors, artists, musicians and filmmakers.
And teasing out some of the recurrent themes, motifs, if you like, Rob, of this latest year of the Monocle Weekly. So don't go anywhere, that's all coming up, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Org, our last weekly of the year. Are you excited?
I'm really excited, Rob. What a year it's been. Am I right?
It certainly has been a year.
It served like any good drama. It saved its shuddering crescendo for last, I think.
Yes, that's right. Enough about the Monocle Christmas party. I trust you had a wonderful time without any interruption from me this year.
Yes, I did. I went home rather earlier than I would have had you been around, I suspect. I think we should get straight into it because we've got loads of great stuff coming up.
Let's do it. We'll start in the summer, Org, shall we? Cast your mind back, if it'll reach that far, to August, when one Natasha Khan, better known as Bat for Lashes, flew in to talk about her latest LP. As an aficionado of the aesthetics of America myself, I was keen to hear more about the way the geography of Los Angeles, both psycho and topographic, had influenced her songwriting.
I did a lot of trips when I first moved, going to Death Valley, which I was just explaining feels like you're in Mars with sort of these weird lavender mountains for miles, and then driving up through giant redwood forests and down the coast. It's very epic and awe-inspiring. And then I was sort of like mixing that with moving to East Los Angeles, where my community is full of lots of Mexicans. So there's loads of like Mexican food, music, and they all congregate in big groups and families. So there's a lot of cool fashion and kind of groups of teenage Mexican cholas and stuff. Yeah. So it's very downtown LA and that aspect. So I suppose I've kind of fused those things together, where there's that deep spiritual kind of strangeness of the landscape, and then these badass like girls that I've been watching and nicking their fashion ideas.
Well, it's good. It looks great. I mean, I like a kind of flowing robe.
Thank you.
And some kind of ceremonial makeup, you know, the rest of it. Yeah, the high collar, the wispy. Oh. Yeah, there's something. Yeah, it's a good look,
I think.
And you kind of take on the character and the mantle of Nikki Pink in the new record. Mm-hmm. What does that do? Does that help you kind of, I don't know, are you creating a new persona, maybe on stage, but certainly as part of the writing process? Is it both of those things?
Yeah, well, I went to LA initially. I wasn't going to do music for a long time because I'd finished my 10-year deal on a major label, and I was like, what am I going to do? And I wanted to go and write scripts and direct. And I actually came up with that Lost Girls narrative. We went to Santa Cruz and saw the Lost Boys Bridge, and I was like getting into all the 80s vampire stuff and the Mexican culture there and all the politics happening with the wall. And there was a lot of sort of juicy stuff I was getting into in terms of characters and narrative. And then Nikki sort of presented herself, and I started writing the songs and realised that, as always, I've sort of created this character as a narrative construct that's this more multi-dimensional, colourful version of like an aspect of me. And I think it really helps me to focus on the themes of the lyrics and the sound and stuff if I have a viewpoint or a sort of a hero's journey in my mind of what this person has to go through to get to the other side of this record or this film. So I think that's how Nikki came out, but it's kind of who I wanted to be. You know, I sort of want to be
She goes with the territory, literally. Yeah. Does that, I mean, people, musicians have obviously taken on characters in order to get them into a creative place and apologise for some of the things that character might say, obviously, as well. Not necessarily Nikki, but others obviously famously have. And is that a thing? Does that kind of take some of the, I won't say pressure, but it can, you know, I guess it alleviates some of the expectation and allows you to become someone else when you're in the studio, when you're on stage, because it's Nikki's doing it, not Natasha.
Yeah, I think it sort of helps you surrender to some subconscious places that perhaps wouldn't come out if you were sort of filtering it through your daily persona. And it's all about, for me, it's all about the mysterious, playful aspects of of myself that, you know, like if I'm channeling it through some weird, wonderful character, then I can, like you say, I can really sort of go to places. I mean, actually, it's a trick I play on myself so that I'm not in my own way.
Okay. You know, creeping up on yourself.
I think I creep up on myself in that way. Yeah, just through sort of convincing my brain that it's not really me, then I can sort of be braver, and also sort of these treats and surprises come out of my subconscious that I wouldn't maybe have thought of.
Subconscious treats.
Yes.
It's an album full of subconscious treats, ladies and gentlemen. Musically, it's a real big, as I say, it's very kind of propulsive. As I say, nice it's impossible word. To say. A very propulsive thing. It's got a very big thing. People use the word widescreen. You are in Los Angeles making this thing, so it kind of goes with that. But there's kind of noir in it. There's everything from kind of Raymond Chandler and like those old rainy streets of Los Angeles right through to kind of the Drive soundtrack and sort of more contemporary things like that. Did you have any kind of touch points? Was it just kind of come out and you try and corral the best bits when you're recording something?
I think what you're saying about...
What are you saying about it, Rob? What I'm saying is...
you're saying a lot. I'm trying to... It's early in the morning. I'm trying to get my...
It's quite early. It's wet. You haven't seen rain for months. Come in here. What are we talking about?
So, firstly, what I wanted to say was being in LA, it is very cinematic because of the light. The light is so different. And so being a very visual person, and I love to make films and paint and do all that kind of thing, it did sort of widen the spectrum of colour and that the scenery of the music was wider. So I think that does relate to how rich and depthful some of the production is. And then driving down Mulholland Drive, you think David Lynch, going to, you know, the beach, I think Point Break, going to Santa Cruz, I think Lost Boys, being in suburban LA, I'm like, I'm in Karate Kid. So wherever I was, there were these touch points. And then they were leading me down film soundtracks of that time and had the Halloween soundtrack. Yeah. And, you know, we passed the Halloween house. Me and my boyfriend were like, oh my God, Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, and we actually saw her in her front garden doing some gardening. But I mean,
did that slightly ruin it for you? Yeah. Oh, she's deadheading the roses.
She's still a badass.
Yeah. But with some really big shears.
Yeah. So I think I really enjoyed getting into the production and the mixing side. I was really hands-on because it was just me and Charles Scott, who I work with mainly. We were really layering up really old synths and finding all these amazing
there's a lot
drum
of warmth
beats.
In those synths
and lots of washy phasey Cure style guitars and so a lot of it had that warm digital stroke analog 80s like warmth to it all, like you were saying. And then the task is just to make sure it doesn't all sound like a big wodge of sound, so the mixing was quite intense.
That was the wonderful Natasha Khan, also known as Bat for Lashes. Back there in the menu, Org, you mentioned some recurrent themes.
Yes, I did, Rob. We've interviewed a lot of people with a view on tech this year. Big tech, little tech, personal tech. They're all of a mind. They're all worried about it, basically. We should unpack their worries because they're really interesting to hear from. We'll start with an interview that I did with Monocle's own Ben Rylan with Jehan Nujaim and Karim Amer. They're a duo of documentarians who made, you might have seen it, Netflix's smash hit, The Great Hack, which explores how society has metabolized the scandal behind Cambridge Analytica, which, as you will probably remember, allegedly used vast amounts of personal data to influence elections. So they spoke about how society's nonchalance towards digital footprints is probably coming to an end.
Here you have something that's all around us, yet we don't really understand it. I think the proof of that is, you know, when you ask people, a lot of people at least, why they're not more concerned with their privacy, they say, well, what do I have to hide? I'm not really doing anything bad. I'm not looking at kiddie porn. I'm not, you know, I'm safe with my, like, bank records and bank numbers. Like, what's the big deal, really? At the same time, you ask people if they feel their phones are listening in on them. And a lot of people will tell you, I think they are, because I'm getting all these very strange ads all the time that there's no way, I never even Googled that. How would it know? So the truth is that we aren't being spied on by our phones. What's happened is we've entered into a new era, and it's the era of surveillance capitalism, whereby we are part of a barter exchange every day where we give our data away and in return we get services. And I think that that's kind of the base assumption of how so much of the new economy works. And for a long time, it was just getting better and better, right? It was like, this is our admission fee into the connected world, and so be it. We have this free connectivity and everything is, you know, accessible, and we're more connected and we're more open and we're more together. However, that pendulum of technology swinging to that side, we didn't realize swung to the opposite side as well. We saw that in Egypt, right? So remember our previous film, The Square, was about Tahrir Square and people coming together in an attempt to, you know, rewrite a new social contract through protest. And we saw those tools be used as this incredible kind of galvanizing force, you know, for giving people the ability to assemble, giving everyone with a camera phone kind of access to being a, you know, amateur member of the press corps, and giving everybody the ability to kind of create community. However, those same tools swung the other way when a more fascistic order took over in Egypt and became used to dissent, to squash dissent, to survey people. And even we saw those tools used for radicalizing people, right? People joining ISIS off of, you know, YouTube videos, et cetera, et cetera. We've seen it on the alt-right. And Silicon Valley was completely absent in that conversation, right? When technology was seen as a democratizing force, they were taking a lot of credit for these tools being so beneficial. When technology was kind of wreaking havoc in some regard, they were not taking any responsibility. And then we saw that pendulum swing here in Western democracy with Brexit and Trump, which we examine in the film. So I think for us, we had been kind of aware of the complications of technology on society, and we had been looking for a story that could kind of bring this to life. And the Cambridge Analytica Facebook story provided the perfect vehicle for doing so.
I think that's a really interesting point that you raised there about the moral flexibility of big tech. You know, on the one hand, when everything's going well, they're grinning from ear to ear. And then when it's not, they say, well, you know, we just provide a service. We just provide a service and that's it. I mean, you see that at every level, don't you, in this film, really? Like from Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook at the top down to Brittany Kaiser, who does come across as a like uniquely morally flexible individual. I know that you said that she had this idealistic kind of career helping Obama in 2008. But latterly, she kind of comes off the rails and doesn't seem that apologetic for it, does she?
I think she felt, being an employee of Cambridge Analytica, what she talks about is this is a job like a lawyer. And so if they asked me to join the NRA and to be able to pitch to the NRA, then that's what I have to do. And in the film, she talks about how she actually thinks that she learned a great deal stepping into the shoes of the other side and then sort of became that person. And so I think in her character, you see, you know, well, she's representative of a lot of us who are complicit, because we are completely complicit in this, and including ourselves. We're still on Facebook, you know. It's just that we just don't feel like we have to. It's a false choice. Do we have to give up all of our privacy in order to be a part of this connected world? I don't think that that should be a choice. But back to Brittany, yeah, she's representative of all of us in a way, in the fact that we're kind of, for convenience, just going along with things, even though we realize that there's something very funky about the fact that we feel like our phones are listening to us.
I mean, for convenience, we're signing contracts every day. And when we click that box because we can't be bothered to read what it entails, and signing away these exchanges that we don't really understand. I think, though, that, you know, what Brittany, what was interesting about Brittany as well is that here we are as, you know, moral creatures who are increasingly being shaped by an amoral algorithm in so many of the decisions we're making. And here was a character who could kind of not only take us through the ascent of this technology as it was used under Obama to inspire hope, to then this technology kind of descending into a different place, a more dark place, where it was being used to kind of weaponize information and sell fear and really prey on people's anxieties in a way that we'd never seen before. And in her journey of going from here to there and then trying to step out of it, we found that that kind of trajectory provided a classical character arc that could reflect upon society at large as to how we all got here and perhaps a way for us to get out. Because you know, what we're needing, in my opinion, in these sour times is stories of redemption. You know, we're so polarized all across the world right now. And, you either leave or remain, or Republican or Democrat, red, blue, whatever it is. And you don't see people switching uniforms. We don't even know how to. So I think that, you know, as Paul Hilder, one of the characters in the film, says, you know, call me romantic, but I believe in societal redemption. And I think that's kind of one of the things that we're calling for in the movie.
That was Org and Monocle's Ben Ryland talking to Karim Amer and Jehane Nujaim. More technophobia later.
Here we are. Welcome back, listener, on the Monocle Weekly. We're basking in the best of a glorious year. Apologies if that sounds self-satisfied. At the moment, we're listening to all the worrying things people told us about big tech.
Indeed. In the last chat, keen-eared listeners may have clocked a reference to surveillance capitalism. Our next highlight unpacks this idea. Rana Faruha is a journalist whose latest book, Don't Be Evil, explores the pivot to villainy big tech has affected over the last decade or so. In this, Augustine asked if the Silicon Valley's fangs ever thought of themselves as the architects of utopia.
I think they were, but I think that moment was brief. One of the things I was most fascinated by in my research is going back to the initial paper that Larry and Sergey, the founders of Google, did on search. And it's online. Anyone could look at it. It's from 1998. They did it while they were grad students at Stanford. And it describes what Google would be, how you would run it, and then at the end, how you would monetize it. And there's a section in the appendix that is titled, I believe, Advertising and Its Discontents. And it talks about how if you use highly targeted advertising to fund a search engine like Google, that you're inevitably going to end up with a conflict between the companies or the, you know, even the public entities that might want to reach consumers and the users themselves, that the interests of the users and the interests of the advertisers may not be the same. And so, in fact, the pair advocates for an academic search engine or some kind of an open system where you could have a nonprofit that would be in the public interest. And it's fascinating because that is exactly where we are today. So they did know from the beginning. But, and I track this in the book, as they got closer and closer to IPO, the venture capitalists were like, where's the business model? And, you know, this is just a business model that can pull in profits like no other business model in history. And P.S., it's becoming everyone's business model. You know, and we talk a lot about the FANG companies and the tech platforms, but Starbucks knows a lot about you. Johnson & Johnson knows a lot about you. You know, healthcare companies, financial companies, everyone is practicing surveillance capitalism today. And it is happening so fast and it is so deep. And that's why I think we need to at least have a clear narrative and a public conversation about it now and decide what do we want the rules to be? Because otherwise we're going to end up like China in a surveillance state.
So as Mammon started it, as always, these technological developments that have kind of gone sour and this link to Frankenstein, I was just thinking about that. And I was thinking about, you know, the technological developments that shaped the 20th century, starting with Marinetti's futurism or the vorticists in the UK, you know, these cultural figures who fetishized machinery, fetishized advancement, and whose bubble was burst quite abruptly by the outbreak of the First World War when they witnessed the horrors of industrialized warfare. Then we invented the bomb. Then we, you know, transport reshaped cities. The streets were privatized and ways to afford rights to motorists rather than pedestrians. All of these things seem to kind of go wrong at some point. Yeah. Why would tech have ever been any different?
It's a great question. I think what's different perhaps this time is just the depth and breadth of change. So I think about what we're going through as a new industrial revolution. It's a digital revolution. You know, if you think about the industrial revolution, probably took about 70 years to play out altogether. I think we're kind of 20 years in. We're at the end of the consumer stage of this transformation, and we're about to go into the Internet of Things, smart machines connected, talking to one another. That is going to put what we've been talking about now on steroids. And one interesting case study of this is actually playing out. Google has a project called Sidewalk Labs. It's a smart city that's being built in Toronto. And until quite recently, Toronto just said, sure, Google, come on in and take over 12 acres of waterfront and put sensors wherever you'd like, gather data, look at people 24/7. And the idea, you know, the benign part of this is it's supposed to help traffic patterns, energy consumption, et cetera. And you can imagine that that absolutely would be the case. But the other side is that Google now owns literally everything that happens within this 12-acre radius, and they were the only ones to get access to it. And as the conversation that we're having has been brewing, suddenly a couple of weeks ago, public officials said, you know what, maybe we'll put this data in a public data bank, and that way taxpayers, citizens can get access to it, can understand what's being done with this data. But also, and this is quite important, smaller companies can also get access, because one of the things that happens is that when a big tech platform comes in and just ring fences huge swaths of data, it creates dark zones where innovators can't go. And so these companies have become kind of the opposite of what they were in the beginning. They were the garage startups. Now they are the giant monopolists that, to my mind, look very much like the 19th century railroad companies.
I'm interested in that because, you know, there's a fair amount made of the kind of Randian underpinnings of Silicon Valley and that kind of growth, that drive to expand. You liken it to the railroads. Is that therefore not so new? Does the state always need to intervene in situations like this to break up monopolies? Will businesses always operate according to these principles? Or is this kind of Randian drive, this unfettered quality, is that something more recent?
That's a really interesting question. So I'll take that in two parts. Mm. I do think that capitalism will do what it's allowed to do. And that is, and you do see these pendulum swings from private sector power to public sector power and back again. You know, in the last 100 years or so, I would say, you know, you had the rise of the railroad monopolies. Then you had just a clear concentration of power that was degrading the overall economic ecosystem. And then you had a reformer like Louis Brandeis, for example, in the U.S. come in. And then you had it swing back towards public power. Same again in the 1920s. You know, you have a market crash. Then you have the New Deal. You had a lot of public power during the wartime periods and the 50s and 60s post-war, kind of more industrial planning in the U.S. And then by the 70s, all right, maybe it was time for the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. Maybe that was appropriate. I think we have reached a pendulum shift now where it is natural and appropriate for the public sector to start taking back some control because concentrations of wealth and inequality are the same that they were in the Gilded Age. However, to go to your point about what's different about the Valley is interesting because, you know, many people out there claim to be liberal or social liberals, let us say. You know, they would tend to vote Democrat. They're very woke. But really, many of them, I would say, are truly libertarians. I mean, they are hyper-capitalists. And think about the people that run these firms. Many of the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Sheryl Sandbergs, you know, they grew up in an era, really from the 1980s onwards, where the government was really just for cutting taxes. You know, there was not a public discussion, particularly in the U.S., about what we could do together collectively as a society. That was very much the greed is good era. And so I think they haven't known anything different. And I think in some ways, a company like Facebook is the apex of the sort of neoliberal economic ethos that we've all been practicing for the last 40 years.
That was Rana Faruha. We've enjoyed doing some interviews together this year, haven't we?
We certainly have, and on occasion on location.org. In September, you and I went to London's Barbican Centre to speak to the artist Trevor Paglen. Some people think that big tech might save us with AI and all that future stuff. But Trevor explained that, unfortunately, it probably won't. He described his installation From Apple to Anomaly and how it revealed inbuilt AI biases that should give us all cause for concern.
The piece is using something called the ImageNet database as its material that it's drawing from. And what ImageNet is the most commonly used data set to train artificial intelligence systems on images, right? In other words, it's the most commonly used data set to program machines to recognize different kinds of objects. ImageNet has about 14 million images in there that are organized into about 20,000 categories. And the piece here, which is called From Apple to Anomaly, Pictures and Words, is looking at that data set and looking at a couple of things. It's looking at what kind of worldview is contained within this data set, what kinds of images are contained within this data set, and what are the politics of that? And by extension, what are the politics that any machine learning system that's trained on this data set will have? So to create the installation, I selected a number of categories from that data set and put them together as almost a kind of montage that goes from right to left as you move through the curve here at the Barbican. And it starts with an apple. You know, to think about what is the kind of most concrete noun that you can imagine. You know, I think we would all look at a picture of an apple and we might all agree that this is a picture of an apple. But as you move through the installation, those concepts get more and more abstract. It goes from apple to apple orchard. Okay, that's maybe a little bit more abstract of a concept than apple. And it moves from there to, you know, different natural landscapes. And as you move further and further to the left, it starts to categorize people. It ends with the concept of anomaly, which people's pictures have been, you know, added to that category. Now, anomaly is a very different kind of noun than apple is. You know, it's a very relational noun. It's a very abstract noun. And that's the point that it's trying to make here, is starting to get a glimpse into the kind of worldview and classifications and really judgments that are built into ImageNet and by extension machine learning systems in general. But there's also a joke at the beginning, which is at the same time as we're beginning to see pictures of apples, there's a photograph of René Magritte's painting called This Is Not an Apple, which is a painting of an apple with the text, This Is Not an Apple. That painting has been classified by a machine learning system trained on ImageNet, and that machine learning system is saying, no, this is an apple. And so you're looking at that from the outset. For me, that piece really sums up the whole installation, which is about looking at images and asking questions about who gets to decide what the meaning of an image is, and what are the forms of politics and histories and biases that go into, you know, any system of classification, really. So you have one axis that goes from these very concrete concepts to more abstract concepts. And along the way, it's a little bit of an impressionistic story about extraction and data and what kind of worlds get created through technology industries and through the various more kind of sociological and political things that go on.
One of the things that very opening image of Magritte's apple teaches us or shows us is that, you know, AI is far more literal than maybe fiction, than maybe some artwork or cinema would have us believe. You know, I think there's this kind of general idea of artificial intelligence as near to conscious. And what we see here is that it's not true at all. What do you think of that sort of cultural idea of AI? I mean, is it something that's potentially quite damaging?
Yeah, one of the jokes that we have in the studio when we talk about AI, we sometimes say artificial intelligence, otherwise known as algebra. Right? It's really, that's what it is. And I think you get a sense of that from the installation as well, which is when, in particular, with object recognition, the AI isn't recognizing anything. What it's doing is looking at formal similarities from, you know, different, you know, from one image to another. And then it's been taught by the people that are creating the data set that, like, this series of formal relationships signifies apple, or this series of formal relationships signifies apple orchard or anomaly or, you know, anti-Semite or whatever it is, you know, in terms of what those categories are. And I think that's one of the things that I hope you get a sense of from looking at the installation, is almost like this sludgy bedrock of crappy images, questionable interpretations, and volume and appropriation and, you know, extraction that forms the bedrock of machine learning systems. And so I hope that you as a viewer get a glimpse into the ways in which AI systems are everywhere infused with politics and biases and the preconceptions of the people who created those data sets.
And do you find, having made this artwork and presenting this artwork, that those preconceptions are sort of perfected, as it were? They are made more prevalent by their increased usage, and AI and algorithms, the more someone clicks on that image, it is deemed to be sort of successful, in inverted commas, or a fair appropriation of that search term or that word. Is that what this bears out to you?
So I think one of the things that I think a lot about, you know, obviously coming from the perspective of somebody who makes images and traffics in images and works with them. So I think a lot always about what kind of work do images do in a society, right? And we can think about historically questions about like what kinds of work do representations of race do, or representation of women do? How does that affect us as a society? How does the creation of images affect our understanding of what is normal or what is neutral or what is good or what have you? And in the past, that's always been done kind of in public, right? You've seen billboards, you've seen advertisements, you can understand what kind of work is going on there culturally. What does it mean to take all of that work and put it into highly technical systems that don't show you what they're doing and yet are still doing work in the world? And so I think about when you hard code these kinds of biases and worldviews into technical systems, they're not going to stay there. They're going to reimpose those worldviews on the actual world and in the places where they're deployed. So I think those are some of the dynamics that I want to think about. And again, like you see that at work right in the beginning with the Magritte image. This is an apple. You see the imposition of that technical understanding of the world.
That was Trevor Paglen in conversation with Org and I. And we'll go from big tech to time travel in a jiffy.
Funny how many people get these things wrong. I go into a lot of jazz clubs and I go, what made you build it like this?
Everyone's got an opinion about design, but join us on a journey to cut through the noise. We sit down with the design greats.
It's just bloody-minded inquisitiveness, really.
And have you covered on everything from architecture to product design, to fonts and fashion too.
There's so many collections being designed. Actually, there maybe is a lifespan on a designer's role at the helm of a brand.
And of course, we're at all the key events in the design calendar with in-depth reports from our global network of correspondents.
2.5 hours by train from Amsterdam lies the historic city of Maastricht, which every year hosts the fabulous TAFAF Fair.
Monocle on Design, if you'd guessed it, is Monocle's weekly design show. Tune in every Tuesday at 20:00 London time, or download the podcast on iTunes or Spotify.
For a celebration of all things print, tune in to The Stack, every week on Monocle 24, featuring expert analysis, the view of magazine veterans, and a look at what's flying off newsstands around the world. The Stack goes beyond the headlines to reveal the inner workings of the print industry.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. We decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Listen to The Stack and hear Fernando Augusto Pacheco in conversation with our favorite editors. And get the latest industry insights from our own editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, airs every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup, live or on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You are with the Monocle Weekly, where we're enjoying a look back at a year of really excellent programming. I was feeling
you've written the script,
especially yourself, complacent obviously. When I wrote this script, I have to say. This year, we spoke to a few people whose endeavours centre around a tactile engagement with the past. We'll hear from a mudlark and a poet in a sec, but first, let's listen to a conservateur.
Simon Gillespie has what might be the most beautiful office in the world. Extraordinary, and I mean extraordinary, paintings are piled deep in corners. He had a Turner and a Titian opposite his desk. Org went to hear more about what he does and how a conservator navigates the line between patina and grime.
I spent a lot of my time educating the owner of paintings, going from that 19th century view that everything has to be 100% perfect, and explaining that everything old will acquire a patina, whether it is dirt, staining, or cracking. We don't have to take all those cracks out. You know, we are falling apart as much as the painting is falling apart. We get older and become more cracky. So it's one of those things, I think, that we are now, the restorer, the conservator now has enough influence in the art world that we can actually say, leave it alone. It doesn't need to be done. I love this business because it's dealing with cultural objects that we can actually literally pick up. We can't go and do that in a museum. We can't go and tap it and see whether it's good condition or not. we can literally pick it up. I love this. You know, that's what I do. And I love to try and impart that to the collector. He's got to really enjoy it as well. And some of my collectors are really interested in the nitty-gritty of what we do and also what they've got as well. And are interested to look after it.
That must be the best type of client, someone who isn't just buying something as an asset, someone who's buying it out of passion, out of engagement.
There are a number of very, very passionate clients, and those are my best people. I just love when they've actually said, Simon, I'm bringing in another picture today, and I've just bought this. And you look it up, see what they bought, and you think, my God, that's going to go really well in your collection. Well done. And then you do get the other guys, which is rather sad. You know, you tell, Simon, I've just bought six pictures. They've all gone into storage. We'd like to go and check them every year. I'm never going to have them at home.
Let's not even go there. You kind of just answered this in a way, or you brought it up, but I'm very interested in how having a tactile relationship with these objects. As you say, you can go to the British Museum every now and then and there'll be a lump of ancient Assyrian rock that someone will let you pick up under supervision. Unbelievably privileged a position to be in, and I'm sure well deserved as well because it's your profession. But how does that change your relationship with objects of art?
I'll tell you one rather lovely, which still brings up the hair on the back of my neck. I normally work by myself in the evening or early in the morning when everybody else has gone home and the phone stops ringing. And with a nice glass of wine and a nice piece of music, you can just get on with just doing the final touches without being interfered with. There was one painting, it was a self-portrait of Franz Hals, and I was doing the finishing touches one evening, and it wasn't much to do, but I was totally engaged with him, sitting, looking at him straight in the eyes, looking at his highlights, doing exactly the same movements that he would have been doing, and placing the tiny little dots paint that were missing on that picture back in, physically doing what he was doing. And I thought I was only there for about half an hour. My wife phoned me up, and it was 12:30, and said, where the hell are you? It was the closest thing to time travel. I knew he was sitting on my shoulder, guiding me what to do. And it was just a relationship we had that evening with Franz Hals. It was the most wonderful piece of cultural exchange over time. It was an honour.
That was Simon Gillespie. You may have heard there how Simon's hands-on relationship with treasures from the past acted as a springboard for a kind of imaginative time travel. Believe it or not, he wasn't our only guest to give an account of such a lovely phenomenon.
Org and I spoke to Lara Makelam back in September. She's a mudlark, part of an historic tradition, and has written about her experiences. Like Simon, she described the power of reaching through time via a lost object or artefact, but she kicked off by giving us an explanation of what mudlarking is.
Basically, the Thames is tidal. And mudlarking is when you go down onto the foreshore when the tide's out and it's low and you look around for history and anything that the tide's left behind. And every tide uncovers something completely different because the river is constantly eroding the foreshore, which is what contains the treasures, and also depositing objects on it. So it's really a treasure hunt. I'm not a treasure hunter. I'm never going to get rich from this. But the things that I find tell the story of the city, the history, the ordinary history of the city. And I've always been fascinated by history, ordinary history of ordinary people. And there's nowhere better really to go and find that. I discovered the foreshore. Well, I moved to London in the early 90s looking for fun. And I found fun, but I also wanted a bit of peace and quiet. And I discovered the river. And for years, I walked along the river until one day I decided to go down onto the foreshore and I found a clay pipe stem. And I reasoned that there was more there and started going back and found more and more. And it gets obsessive because you never know what you're going to find next.
I can imagine. And it's like this really incredible education in history, as you say. It's sort of learning history through practice, through doing, rather than through reading about it. Does each new find that you come back with kind of open up another branch of learning when you go and research a coin or an object?
It does. It really does. And it's just ordinary objects that connect you to these points in history, whether it's a burnt roof tile that you can imagine. A lot of it's imagination because you can't prove anything with these objects. But if you find a roof tile that was around during the Great Fire of London and it's burnt, you can reason that it might have been burnt in the Great Fire. And it brings all these images to mind. And it's a real hands-on history. Like, I liken it to time travel because you're reaching back through the past to actually hold something that nobody's held since the day it was lost, sometimes up to over 2,000 years ago. This is near complete Roman pot, and it dates, it's almost 2,000 years old. And it
That's not bad, is it, for walking down the river?
It's incredible that this was lying on the surface of the foreshore.
Yeah.
I found it out in the estuary. It's made from local clay. If you go out to the estuary, it's just thick, thick clay. Mm. And that's what they used to make these pots. They made them close to the river so that they could then send them up to Londinium or out to the Empire. And there were a lot of potteries out there. So if you're lucky, you do occasionally find complete ones.
That's amazing. I mean, that's stunning.
It's incredibly sturdy. It's also sort of lined with these barnacles.
Yes.
It's kind of maybe only 2 degrees removed from the, as it might have been.
I love this. I mean, this in my hands.
Well, yeah. You're probably only about the fifth person to touch it since I found it. So it's...
I'm highly honoured.
Yes.
Thanks,
yes. Straight from the hands of the Romans.
I'm going to pass it. I'll go off mic from just, it. So I make sure I pass it carefully to you.
Don't drop it. With these objects, in the book you make it clear, as you've just described, that a lot of them are very nice, are beautifully preserved because they emerge from the mud, this kind of oxygen-free mud that keeps things almost pristine. They suddenly kind of oxidize or break apart on contact with the air, and that for you it's important to discover them. I wondered about kind of what you think of these objects, because there's also a bit where you talk about that they're finite and that if one doesn't find them, the river will eventually destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
Are they there waiting for us to find them, or do we find them incidentally? Do they belong to the river or do they belong to us, I suppose, is what I wondered.
Well, I believe they belong to the river. It's the river's treasure trove. And that's why I only collect what the river gives me. I reason that if it's lying there, then the river's ready to give it up. If it's buried a foot down in the mud, it's safe and the river's looking after it. And you run the risk, if you go digging into the foreshore, of damaging and breaking things if you wait until they erode. But then it's difficult, because then when they do come out, something like leather, it vanishes so quickly because it's so delicate, but it's been perfectly preserved. And this pot, if I'd got to it quicker, it might have been complete. But I don't know. It's a philosophical... It's something to debate, isn't it? I mean, it's that's my philosophy on it. I don't believe you should be digging into the foreshore for many reasons, because when you dig into the foreshore, you run the risk of damaging things. Most people who dig into the foreshore use metal detectors, so they're missing things that aren't made of metal. And when you dig into the foreshore, it's very compact. When you dig into it, you destabilize it. And because erosion is already so bad on the river, it starts to eat into these areas that have been dug over, and it scoops them out like butter. I've seen it happen. And so you're increasing erosion just for the sake of finding something, you know, sort of now, rather than waiting for it.
Just finally, do you now feel when you go for a walk along the foreshore that you're going mudlarking, or are you still kind of just going for a walk? Is there a pressure to find things, or are you still in the same state of mind you were 15 years ago whenever you first moved to London and kind of accidentally happened upon this pastime?
I suppose it's changed a little bit because I've moved out of London, so I haven't got that need to escape the city anymore. I have a different relationship with the river. I used to pop down for 20 minutes at a time just to escape the city. Now I mudlark for 5 to 6 hours at a time, but it's still very meditative for me. And I can't imagine not going down there and not looking. I'm just one of those people that looks down all the time. So, you know, even if I went for a walk, I'm still going to be looking down.
That was Lara Makelam. We'll have some more highlights just after this.
We've heard from just a handful of our wonderful interviewees from across the year, but let's end today with a word from author and poet Ben Lerner.
His latest novel, The Topeka School, explores masculinity and language in America. It's a truly incredible book, and as you'd hope, Ben speaks very interestingly all about it. Though it's set in the 1990s, among its other accomplishments, it offers fascinating insights into how America found itself in the pickle it has done. Here, he explains how the end of history myth created a moral vacuum into which something bonkers and worrying has slid.
I think the end of history narrative is interesting in that way, right? Because part of it was kind of like, well, what do you do now? You kind of have every material thing you could want or whatever. And a lot of the traditional sources of identity, which I'm not like nostalgic for, like I'm not saying we should return to the 1950s. We know what that leads to, right? I mean, that's the Trump fantasy. But a lot of the traditional sources of meaning had been kind of emptied out. Like even in a place where I lived, Like, just think about it in terms of the landscape. Like, instead of, like, you know, the downtown is replaced with a peripheral mall or strip mall, right? The local businesses are replaced with these franchises, which are the exact same franchises in the exact same order wherever you go, you know, so that if you drive out of Topeka for 30 minutes and you pull off into another town, it's the same Applebee's, Olive Gardens, whatever. So that the landscape's interchangeability really is a kind of phenomenology of redundancy, right? So that eradication of particularity, I think, is part of the kind of vacuum I'm talking about. The language isn't local anymore. It's from television. The manners of dress and address are being borrowed by these white kids from, like, watching, you know, hip-hop videos on BET after school or whatever. So that there is a way in which the landscape of a certain moment of capital and its standardization eradicates any kind of local sources of meaning or value. And then, you know, how is that vacuum filled? I think that vacuum can be filled, is often traditionally filled for men, and particularly white men in America, by violence, misogyny, homophobia. I'm going to define myself by the violent demotion of some other. And part of, like, what's important about James Baldwin's early writing about race is his emphasis on the fact that there's no such thing as white people, right? It's a lie. It's a made-up construct that only exists based upon the demotion of some racist other called, like, the black person, right? Or the African-American person. And so there's a sense in which it necessarily creates this vacuum, because you've lost, as Baldwin talks about, you've lost the power to define yourself because you've only defined yourself through this racist fantasy of another. Part of what's happening now, I think, with, like, Trump supporters, for example, I mean, which are not monolithic, there are many different kinds, but is this idea that, like, there's been a kind of deconstruction of whiteness or a shame about whiteness or whatever, that without there being, like, a new loving political vocabulary in its place, and then this, like, charlatan con man comes and gives everybody permission to just be, like, a racist again. Right. And there's this kind of, like, libidinal discharge. Like, I don't have to be ashamed anymore. And I have a new enemy. I mean, the enemies are, like, many and varied. The enemies are the anti-Semitic rhetoric of the enemies of the people. That's the media. But obviously the immigration focus is, like, one of the oldest forms of reviving a kind of hate that can give white people identity. But it's not, you know, Trump supporters, it would be really great if Trump supporters were just economically deprived people who felt left behind, which is what liberalism would lead you to believe, but they're not. I mean, Trump doesn't win because of just poor white rural voters. Trump wins because of college-educated, middle-class white people, too, who are enthralled by the idea that they don't have to apologize anymore for whiteness. They think of themselves as white people. But again, it's that myth of whiteness that can only exist so long as you're detaining families at the border, as long as you have some racialized other that you can define yourself in opposition to.
Trump is a really bum out place to sort of wrap it up. Yeah. But,
well, that's our world.
That description that you had of the homogenization of the American landscape,
yeah,
that point in capitalism, that's a complaint against globalism. It's something that we have here, the death of the high street, the ascendance of Amazon and all that.
Right.
Seems like there are a couple of responses to it. One is, you know, this kind of bougie, I'm only going to buy meat from my local butcher.
Right.
I love crafts. I'm going to spend, like, huge amounts of money on a hand-tooled leather rucksack. And the other is this kind of Brexity isolationist shutting down of everything and, like, return to nostalgia.
Right.
I suppose it's nostalgia that seems pretty critical and seems pretty dangerous in how you address it.
Yeah.
I wonder if Trump in the US, if I don't know what your perspective on Brexit is, but this kind of analogous, although not as extreme, right-wing populist movement in the UK, whether this kind of regressive conservatism is the triumph of that kind of nostalgia, of a kind of atavism, or whether it's, in your opinion, the pendulum reaching the kind of upper end of its arc before it sort of swings back.
Boy, I really don't know. I mean, I think that we definitely need, and I don't pretend to have it, like, a third way, but the two options. I mean, I think these are the two options that we feel stuck with, is either this, like, elite artisanal simulation of a return to the local, or a populist nostalgia that's a right-wing return to some kind of blood and soil discourse. And if those are the only two options, we're truly in trouble, right? And I think that part of the issue is the total failure of the left to be able to produce a third option. And that's what has to happen. Because the part of, like, the Trump supporter that I understand is the part that's like, oh, like, well, you live in New York and you fly on airplanes and you're hurting the environment too. It's just that your hamburger costs $27 and is grass-fed or whatever, whereas, like, I go to McDonald's and you look down on me. Like, we're equally guilty, but you feel superior. That structure of feeling makes some sense to me, right? Which is why you have a Trump who's, like, valorized for being stupid and who gets celebrated every time he, like, serves McDonald's at the White House. It's kind of a permission to be shameless on the topic of shame. I think there has to be a real left vocabulary that's like addressing things like climate and things like inequality and also positively articulating a vocabulary of like love, possibility, belonging, excitement. Because otherwise, we're just all going to be neocons, right? Which is what's happening a lot now. It's like, you know, we were all like in the U.S., like suddenly like me and all my Marxist friends were like, where's the CIA? Can't the CIA stop this, right? Or it's like talking about like Brexit. It's like now all of a sudden, I feel like I have to uncritically defend the European Union, right, which is also totally incompatible with my politics, right? So that's like the trap, is that we get trapped in like a Clinton-like neoliberalism because it seems like the only thing we can use to oppose the fascistic regression of the right. And there actually has to be some third way. And the small contribution I feel like literature can make to that is in part by like thinking about the pleasure and the bodily possibilities. This is kind of what 1004 is about, of like harnessing the libidinal for the political.
That was Ben Lerner, and that was The Monocle Weekly in 2019.
We will, of course, be back next year, next decade, in fact, with more and more. But until then, thank you all very much for tuning in. Please feel free to relay any thoughts on this year's programming to Org, the show's producer, who is on ama@monocle.com.
I look forward to hearing from you if you're inclined to write in. Thanks for listening, and thanks more than that to the wonderful and multi-talented Maylee Evans, who was our editor and studio manager this year.
So it just falls to us, Org, to wish our listeners a very
happy New Year.